I would like to welcome you all to a special session with a dynamite lineup of speakers, and we're going to focus on building a movement against inequality. So we'll have 90 minutes here, and what I'd like to do is briefly introduce our speakers, and then each of them is going to speak now. And I would like to welcome you all to a special session with a dynamite lineup of speakers. And we're going to focus on building a movement against inequality. So we'll have 90 minutes here, and what I'd like to do is briefly introduce our speakers, and then each of them is going to speak from 5 to 7 minutes. I will be a fierce, very fierce enforcer. And then we're going to open it up for conversation. And let's see if by the end of this session we don't have a clearer idea about where as a movement we should go. So let me first introduce our speakers. We have Barbara Garson, who is a veteran of FSM. And who wrote as a student at UC Berkeley, McBird, which was a play which ultimately sold 500,000 copies. Very heady accomplishment at an early age. In addition to other plays, she's written many books. One, All the Live Long Day, a 1975 classic. And her latest book is Down the Up Escalator, How the 99% Live, very appropriate for our session. Second, we have Jack Weinberg of the famous 32-hour stay in the police car fame. The man who actually kicked off the free speech movement by refusing to give his ID to the police as he sat behind his core table, and who refused to leave the car and led to this whole movement. He's since become a tremendous activist in the environmental movement. He's worked with Greenpeace and been arrested a number of times. He was in with Greenpeace in Manila as one of 26 Greenpeace activists, delivering PCB waste to the American embassy to remind it that it had severely polluted grounds in its former military base. So he hasn't lost the spirit. Stephanie Kuntz is well known to many of us as a New York Times op-ed regular, a teacher of history at Evergreen State College, and an active researcher with the Council on Contemporary Families. She's written a book I've often assigned called The Way We Aren't,
Never
The Way
Were.
Never Were. Yeah.
But also arrested in free speech.
Yes, okay. And our other final panelist, Azumi Mizukami, is an activist with Wages Raise the Wage, ROC campaign in L.A. to get a living wage for all food workers in L.A. and around the country. So thank you all for being with us. And let's start with Barbara.
Oh, I can speak whichever you prefer. Well, can you hear me? Okay. Now, we FSMers activated in the beginning of the fall of 64. The off-campus issues that made the people around us in Oakland and the rest of California so angry were our
activities on behalf of the farm workers, our equal employment picket lines all around the area, and they wanted to put a stop to us. Now, at that time, some of us called ourselves socialists, like I did, and Stephanie did, and some of us even called ourselves communists. But the funny thing is, we paid very little attention to the real class struggle that was going on and was about to expand around us. If you asked us what we were doing on behalf of farm workers and blacks, I think most of us would have felt that in this time of general prosperity, we were helping marginal groups come into the general prosperity. We were working for fairness for those who were especially minorities, marginal groups. And none of us really thought about American working class, including ourselves. But by the time we got out of school, a war had begun, a war that was just very simple, to take away the wages of ordinary working people and transform them into, or take bigger shares as returns for capital, you know, as your return interest and your dividends. And by the 1970s, it started with industrial workers. And jobs were moved abroad where they were done for a dollar an hour instead of $15 an hour. People lost their health insurance. They lost their regularities of their jobs. And we were told then, oh, listen, these are just old-fashioned blue-collar workers, a few troglodytes that can't be retrained, but the rest of us are going to be information workers in the post-industrial society. Well, most of you were probably information workers, and certainly your children are, if you're from the FSN. And you know very well that these information workers don't have wonderful jobs. When are your kids going to get settled? It's a part-time job. It's a contract job. It's a so much an hour. They're PhDs in French literature, and they go from school to school like migrant workers. Their standard of living is attacked, too. They're still doing the work, but a larger share of the value that they put in goes to the capitalists. I mean, I'm really telling you the Piketty story, and if you can't finish Piketty's book, you will finish down the up escalator because it's got the human version of this story. So this econom, and if you need to assign your students, and see, I actually make a living writing. I'm not a professor. But anyway, so this attempt to take more from working people reached higher and higher up the economic ladder. And now if you come to a student to go to this Berkeley campus, you will find that the students are paying $12,800 a term for school year for school, when we paid zero. That's what I paid at UC Berkeley. If you were for out of state, you paid $600. Now, why is this college so expensive? It's not that expensive. It's cheaper than a lot for a good value. But basically, the financiers, the people who tried to keep us down in Berkeley, simply have had a successful rebellion against paying taxes. When you and I went to Berkeley, 70% of its budgets came from federal and state revenues. Now it's something like 11 or 12%. They have to make it up. They're not, believe me, they're not paying the adjuncts that much. They're making it up by taking from students. And the students have to have loans to do this. Student loans are the most outrageous loans in the country. And wait till I tell you how they are justified, or how they were justified then. But student loans, first of all, they can't be refinanced. So if you borrowed in the 90s, as some of your children may have, or the 80s, and you borrowed at 8%, you're still paying 8%. There's no bankruptcy in student loans. And that's very un-American. It is a very American tradition. We have low supplemental care for people, but you have the opportunity to do it over and over. That's very much a part of the American system. You go out west, you go bankrupt. No bankruptcy. Goes on for the rest of your life. They can garnish wages. That's outlawed for most other loans in most states. They can garnish Social Security, food stamps, unemployment checks, even disability. Believe me, if this was a mafia loan at 8%, you wouldn't need to break legs if you had those powers to collect. And those powers are being used right now against students who don't pay. Most extraordinarily, there's no truth in lending in student loan, or very few of the truth in lending laws apply to student loans. Now, what that means, I saw in my own family. But, well, I just want to mention that the justification for all these very harsh terms when they were introduced in the 70s, because they really were surprising. These are unique in loans. And at that time, the Congress sent some of them back, and they went re-over, and then the ALEC wasn't around, so they couldn't dictate the terms that quickly. They had to restate them, in other words. So, and they really objected to them. And one of the justifications given, believe it or not, was they pointed to the students of the 60s, the student rebels of the 60s, and they said, look, these people don't believe in the establishment. They are not going to repay their loans. They created a kind of a Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman version of the FSMers and said, we have to protect ourselves against these. We have to make them ironclad and on very harsh terms. And that, of course, is not why it got through. It got through because who they were. They can push things through. But that was a thing they said. It was if we had been paying attention to them, it would have been very embarrassing. Actually, student loans performed very well at the time, so they were not entitled to special treatment. Well, why? Well, these loans are very, very oppressive. And this truth in lending business, you think, well, yeah, I was just told that I'm speaking for 5 to 7 minutes. So I'm not going to give you all the heartbreaking examples I collected from people who paid mortgage size debts in order to get worthless credentials from for-profit colleges. Oh, I am speeding so much. Look what you did to me. I'm usually such an amiable speaker. But anyway, if you just look around our own situation, I'm going to take something so small. My husband's daughter, wonderful girl, darling, put herself through college herself, onto a PhD, runs a family, runs a business. But she wasn't quite comfortable with me at first, to be sure. And it was hard to ask. Everything is always hard to ask about money. And one time I kind of asked her about the student loan. And she said, that's all right, we're doing okay, we're managing. Well, it turns out, when she finally had to tell me that she basically owed $83,000 on a $60,000 loan after 14 years of paying. How? This is where truth in lending comes in. Well, when she stopped to have a baby, and at the beginning they offer you moratoriums, when you have a baby they offer you a forbearance, they don't tell you that under the principle of capitalized interest, the interest that you're not paying to that during that period will be added to the principal. And remember, you're paying 8%. Believe me, you pay that $100,000 over many times. And who does that money go to? It goes to financiers. It goes to the people who tried to stop us at Berkeley. And basically, they have a lien on the future incomes of educated Americans. Now, I'm just saying this because it reached the educated Americans, and because I think student loan fighting it will be part of our solution. But those are not the only kinds of loans that happened. While people were being paid less and less for the same jobs, their bosses got a very good idea. I know what. Instead of paying you to buy what you produce, I'll lend you the money. Does that sound like a sound economic principle? No, it's obviously a pyramid scheme. If you don't have $10 this year, how are you going to pay me back $15 with interest next year if your income isn't going up? This led to the crash we had and will lead to continuing crashes. It also makes us a debt society. Student debts, auto loan debts, mortgage debts, debts for things that should be
part of the public things, going to school. That should be something we do for each other because we want an educated population, because we want people to be at a school like the University of California. Now it's your business because you're going to earn some money in the future, maybe. And don't you think the students are worried about earning money and pay? You think they have time to do the things we did? No. They're worried, and I don't blame them. These loans are terrible, and the loans apply to men in many other categories because basically we have lowered people's wages to the point that they can't buy back what they produce. I'm not going to go into an economic theory here, but obviously that leads to crises over and over, one debt crisis after another. And Jack's going to tell you more about that, but I think that's the area, the indebtedness of people to in order to do things that used to be public, in order to things that were obvious for working people, they now have to borrow the money to do them. And that's because wages have gone down. And I have to say, we socialists at Berkeley were really not paying attention, except for Jack, over the years, who went to work in a factory right after he graduated, or didn't graduate. What happened to Jack? Right after they let him out of the police car. He understood what was happening to the American working class, and now that our own children are part of that oppressed American working class, I think we're going to have a general movement, not a movement of this or that marginal group who we think we are going to help up into the comfortable middle class.
Hi, I have to lower expectations for this talk. Economics is not my area of expertise or not the area that I'm currently working in. But when we were planning this panel, we thought it was important to say a few things both about the trends in growing inequality and make some reference to the recent book this year, the sensation, Capitalism in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty. And Lynn was trying very hard to get somebody from the economics school to do that. And last minute she said, well, we couldn't find anybody, so why don't you do it, Jack? So so you're going to have to take what you can get from me. I handed out a piece of paper just so I can give some numbers without people going crazy. You don't have to look at it right now. I'll call your attention to it in a moment. We've been, ever since the Occupy movement, there's been a lot of talk about the 99%, the 1%. A lot of that was based on data that Thomas Piketty and a number of other economists around the world have been collecting, trying to document trends in income and trends in wealth for as long a period as they can in as many countries as they can. And then Thomas Piketty, a book of his was translated this year from French into English called Capitalism in the 21st Century. It's a 600-page, very boring book, but readable. I'm not an economist. I had to sort of fall asleep a few times reading it. But it's actually a book that every person in this room can, nothing flashy about it. You can read it through page by page and know what it says. And it's a very important book. And it's been treated it appears from what I read in the press and what I read about it, that it is changing much of the discourse within the economics community, among economists. It has blown up some bubbles. And I believe that it is changing the discourse on the questions of inequality in the United States in the period ahead. I mean, this was the best-selling book that Harvard University Press ever put out. It was sold out on Amazon. It's been a New York Times nonfiction bestseller for a very boring, dry, long book on economics. In a very short way, here's what he said. He said, if you go back into long history, the traditional character of societies has been a very small elite group that had the concentration of all wealth and power, and a very large part of society who really had no way of joining that group other than by birth or marriage. that there was no other way to get into that group. And that's been the history of humanity, with the United States up through the 19th century as an exception because of the very rapidly growing population in the United States, allowed for a society that did have opportunity, equality, a person with little could get more, people could rise. But the upward mobility of American society was atypical of world history. And by the end of the 19th century, the United States was beginning to approach the direction of European societies. Then, in 1914, World War I broke out. And the period of World War I, followed by the Great Depression, followed by World War II, led to a period of massive destruction of capital. And the trends that had been historic up to that time changed because of this destruction of capital. And so you had a period of time where the differential of equality in power changed. Changed in Europe, changed in the United States. And that this created an understanding, a belief, both in politics and economics, that the trend is toward rising equality, that the trend is toward it. We are done with those societies where you have your power and status by birth. We are now in societies where the person who is intelligent, the person who is hardworking, the person who is ambitious can get ahead. And that was the ethos in the United States and Europe through a period of time, through the 50s, through the 60s, and then sometime, and I'll get to this in the political terms in a moment, sometimes in the 70s and 80s, that trend ran out. And he does this in a much more systematic way. His projection is, moving forward, we are, unless there are political interventions that subvert that, the economic trend is moving back to a society that is highly polarized, a small, wealthy group that becomes increasingly difficult to enter except by birth or marriage, and a vast majority of people at various levels, but a vast majority of people who are outside of that. And that has not only economic implications, but that also that has social and political implication in terms of the exercise of power, in terms of the shape of society, in terms of the kind of laws and the kind of ethos. And the basic formula, and I'm not going to go into much of formula because I'm not, as I say, basically his formulas come down to this. He looks at two numbers in any society. One is the rate of growth of the economy, and one is the rate of return on wealth. And his thesis is when the rate of return on wealth is greater than the rate of growth of the economy, then you have an increasing concentration of wealth being concentrated in a small group of people, and that trend, unless it is politically countermanded, is inexorable. So that's, and there's much more in the book, but I think that's the main thrust of the book. I think that since that book came out, the number of articles I read in mainstream press, opinion pieces, and others, it's beginning to affect the discourse. And I've been a little bit distressed that my friends on the left have not been paying as much attention, in many cases, as the economists. 3 minutes. Oh, boy. All right, so What I've done now is I have this piece of paper, and I use data from a database that Piketty and his friends put together that you can also access, that you can get almost all the data you want on wealth and inequality from it. And I looked at the trends in wealth and income distribution in 1964, the year of the FSM, 1980, the year Ronald Reagan got elected president, and today. And you can see that between 1964 and 1980, not much changed. We were still in the post-war period. But between 1980 and today, and if you look at the adjusted income of the 90% of the population, it was 28,000 1964. It was 33,000 in 1980. It's 31,000 today. It stayed more or less the same, and it's actually gone down since 1980. If you look at the top 10%, it goes up much faster. If you look at the top 5%, the top 1%, the top 1/10 of 1%, the top 1/10 of 1% was about between 1 and 1.5 million a year. This is including capital gains in 64 and 80, and it's 6 million a year now. So the trends are real. Just say thing, Ronald Reagan in the political side of this story, and that is Reagan got elected governor of California by appealing to the resentment against black liberation, the resentment against students, and ever since Reagan, this has been the strategy of the economic conservative Republicans. They could never get enough votes to be in power on their own. They needed a coalition, the black movement, the women's movement, the right to, the right for a safe abortion. Every social movement that came up, they mobilized and organized and intensified resentment against that, and then used that resentment to build a base for an economic conservative policy that couldn't have had a base itself, have changed the economics of the country to a growing inequality. And I believe, I'll finish with this thought, the two ethical struggles that the world has before it, not just the United States, but the whole world has before it, is one, are we going to move back to that kind of royal society with gross inequality, or are we going to move back to a more equitable society with opportunity for all, and are we going to have a planet that we can live on? Those are the two epical, it's the same forces we're fighting for both, and I wanted to share this data and share that sort of very simple presentation of a very important economic discussion that's going on today and that we all have to, I believe, should take our movements and our struggles and integrate it with those very important ideas. Thank you.
Well, 1964 was also the start of the war on poverty. And as the daughter of a left-wing labor organizer, I remember how skeptical I was and many of my friends were, you know, how much we thought the war on poverty was just a sham. In retrospect, it actually looks like, in comparison to what we have today, you had the food stamps, the Medicare, Medicaid, Title I, the Child Nutrition Act, AFDC, the House, and Nixon himself, a Republican, proposed a guaranteed income program in 1969. The House of Representatives passed a minimum income bill in 1970, although it was rejected by the Senate. By 1979, 82 of every 100 poor children in America were getting cash welfare. That's compared to 27 of every 100 today. The minimum wage then could support a family of three above the poverty level. Now it can't even support a family of two above the poverty level. The poverty rate of elders had been halved in just 12 years, and the poverty rate of children reduced substantially, and their hardships reduced substantially. Now, of course, this was a period of tremendous racial and gender discrimination. Men's real wages rose by 50% during the two decades after World War II, but women's remained totally flat, and black men's, of course, remained behind. The highest paid black women and, the highest paid black workers and the highest paid women workers still made not quite as much as the average paid white men in that period. If you had a college degree as a black or a woman, you earned less than a man with a high school degree. And in fact, from 1950 to 1980, we saw the feminization of poverty as rising real wages for men and increased divorce rates led to more women moving into poverty or more men escaping from poverty, something that's been reversed, by the way. I hear a lot of my feminist friends still talk about the feminization of poverty. We've actually seen a defeminization of poverty in the last 20 years. And that's what I want to concentrate on a little bit, is the more complex dynamics of inequality today. You know, white male entitlement was very real in the 1960s, even for men in the lowest education and occupations. But it's a little more complicated today. Since 1979, real wages have fallen dramatically for males with a high school graduate, for male high school dropouts, and even for males with associate degrees, while those of women with the same educational credentials rose, at least until the recent recession. Of course, I'm not saying that, you know, that women have become the richer sex. One of the ironic results of the massive increase in job insecurity and wage declines for male workers has been a multiplication of single-parent families, and those are the poorest in the country, many of them with poverty rates of less than 50%, with incomes less than 50% of the poverty rate. But all in all, and incidentally, one of the things that's really interesting to see about this is that among married couples in the bottom 30% of the income, 70% of wives earn more than their husbands. That's the only segment of the population where you see women earning more than men. But all in all, we're seeing a class polarization that cuts across gender lines and even across some racial and ethnic lines. Today, the highest paid Black workers, the highest paid female workers, earn much more than the average male wage or the average white wage. You still have the big problem that people face is the growing wage inequality. And the losses for men have just been stunning. Even though they're not down to women, half of the improvement in women's wage rates relative to men and for the bottom 60% of the population has just been because of men's losses. The silver lining in all this, of course, is that these problems have spread so far beyond the sectors of the population that can be otherized. You know, the poor, people we're supposed to pay pity for, racial minorities, women, that in some ways it is, I think, increasingly possible to raise universalistic demands. In the 1960s, attacking the gender and racial gap in wages meant challenging white men's traditional advantages. Today, however, the main issue facing most men as well as most women, most blacks, most minorities, is the proliferation of low-wage work and the fact that because historically women and minorities are more concentrated in low-wage jobs, that means that even though there is this elite emerging among women and African Americans and other minorities of high earners, nevertheless the gap increases because of the gap between high and low-wage workers. Got 3 minutes. I might as well slow down here. okay, so I had a lot more statistics that I was going to throw out when I was originally told I had 20 minutes to talk about that. But let's stop and look at the policy things that we were asked to do. Now, government programs still help, of course, despite some of the cutbacks. Today, 16% of the population receives food stamps, 27% receive Medicaid, another 16% receive Social Security, 15% receive Medicare. Without those programs, poverty rates would have risen by another 6% points between 2007 and 2012. Nevertheless, we still have higher poverty rates after tax and after transfer programs than 20 of 21 countries that were recently studied by the United Nations. Only Mexico does worse. My colleague at the Council on Contemporary Families, Philip Cohen, has broken down what of these programs help and what hurt in terms of poverty and especially child poverty. Tax credits for low-wage jobs and dependent children, which come as cash refunds to many poor families, reduce child poverty by about 7%. Food stamps bring it down by about 3%. But medical payments, transportation, and child care each drive about 3% more children into poverty because of those things. Payroll taxes push another 1.6% of children below poverty. And, of course, the multiplication of low-wage jobs that we've been talking about is a really, really major obstacle. So where do we go? Of course, you could expand the child tax credit for those with children, or use the tax code to ensure a minimum income for everybody, presumably in combination with government jobs. Of course, we need a higher minimum wage. We need state-provided child care and paid family leave and sick leave. You know, America is, of all of the Western industrial countries, the only one where workers are not guaranteed a single paid sick leave day. Wage protection for part-timers, of course, more affordable health care. We know from the 1960s that government can play a big role. No matter if it was inadequate in terms of what we wanted, there was a huge impact of the war on poverty. But we have a more recent model as well. In 1999, Great Britain had a much higher child poverty rate than we do today. And at that point, they embarked on a war on poverty. The government introduced new work requirements for welfare, but also established a minimum wage that was much more generous than the one we have in the U.S. Family leave for new mothers was extended to 1 year, with half of it paid, meaning that low-income women did not have to quit their jobs and therefore decrease their wage-earning power when they had a child. Legislators also put in place a system of income supports for all but the richest parents, not conditional on employment, and intended to increase investment in child well-being. And finally, the government introduced free preschool for all 3- and 4-year-olds, made it easier for parents to request part-time or flexible employment, and involved in educational investment and school reform. These initiatives together amounted to an increased investment in children totaled to just 1% of Britain's gross domestic product. That doesn't sound very undoable, does it? And yet that resulted in just less than a decade in a 1/4 to 1/2 decrease in child poverty. So all of these things are eminently doable. What is standing in our way? There is even latent support for our doing it. A new poll to be released October 2nd finds that 75% of voters favor candidates who support paid family and sick leave. There's strong support for raising the minimum wage. 82% say the government has a responsibility to ensure that workers get fair treatment and equal pay. And Dan Ariely at, I think he said Harvard, has shown that when you show people a graph of the income distribution in America, they hate it. They like the one in Sweden until they're told that, oh, no, this is ours. So I think one of the real challenges we face, though, is to counter the equally strong support for individual entrepreneurship, the suspicion of so-called handouts, the mistrust of government efficacy, and the knee-jerk reaction against words like welfare or even government programs or social programs. And I feel passionately about this because my work at the Council on Contemporary Families involves us trying to learn to talk about these issues in ways that people can hear and will respond to, rather than in ways that alienate them and don't start where they are. So that way, I think one of that's the major challenge for us, that we have to change our talk from a tone from compassion, pity for others, to understanding that we're all in the same boat, but also to get away, to in some ways, as one of the people who raised a question today at the very end of the program said, the very triumph, and it is a victory, it is a real victory, how much people support interpersonal equality on the basis of gender, race, sexuality. But at the same time, that tremendous support makes it even harder to explain to some people that with, in their impression, the fact that discrimination is bad, we should never allow it, well, then why are some people, and particularly some people, because of historical reasons, continuing to be poor? So I don't think it's just the people from the top who are standing in our way of winning these. I think we really have to rethink our 1960s rhetoric about how to explain these issues to people.
We'll hear from Zumi.
Yeah? Hi, everybody. I know you all are thinking, what is a 16-year-old doing up here on the panel? But I'm actually a little older than that. I'm like pushing 30. And I really appreciate the talk that Barbara was starting about debt and the spiral that a lot of us are in. And even as a younger person, I know that a lot of my friends, whether or not they have college debt, they have debt. And it's coming to a point where I think people are just like, well, I guess if you're going to be an American, and some people are going to have to fight for their right to get papers and fight for their right to be seen as an American, you're going to have debt. And that's just one of our characteristics. One of my friends said that the other day, was like, well, it just seems like that's what you have to do to live in this country and to survive. I'm a college graduate, and you know, paying off debt is not anything light. And a lot of people in my generation are actually just going back to school, going back to community college, going to grad school, just trying to defer their loans because nobody can actually get a job that is stable enough to pay off any kind of debt. So it's kind of a crazy world right now. I represent a generation also that is working off of multiple jobs to pay the rent, and not to mention the folks that are raising children by themselves mostly. And that's where I'm coming from Los Angeles. I'm a restaurant worker. For the past 10 years, I've been working in restaurants, and I meet all kinds of people that are in different situations, people that are raising families, have immigrated here, and have been working in restaurants for 20-plus years, still making the same wage that they made 10 years ago. And people who are in grad school and got stuck, like, not getting anywhere because of the same economic situation that we're talking about. So it's like a really wide range of people that are working in the low wage industry, which, like a lot of you have mentioned, is growing and is becoming part of our norm in terms of like holding a job down. So I think what's happening from my experience is that people are just getting really, really angry and tired. And all of these multiple issues that are happening at one time are just bursting people into, I just think, like balls of anger. So I worked in a restaurant for a couple of years, and we started noticing that our wages were being stolen from us. So slowly and surely we were organizing ourselves, and this is last year, and we started to reach out to different resources and started like training ourselves on our rights, because I think also another aspect of being a low wage worker is you're working so much that you don't have time to even install like new information into your mind, and that whole mind trap of just being a worker and answering to the big boss, who is answering to another big boss, who's answering to another big boss, is you're just becoming a machine. So you don't, it's really hard to like, okay, well, recognize that we have rights, as people, not just as citizens, as people, because, you know, we have rights. Even if you're undocumented, you have rights as a worker. And so a lot of my coworkers are undocumented and immigrant workers. And we decided to teach ourselves more about what we're protected under and what we have the right to do. And so the collective power started building, and now we're in a wage claim process with the state, and we've been in that for about 7 months. So I know there's a lot of statistics about wage discrepancy, and a lot of that is very like real to people, and to be making such a low wage and to being treated like a machine and expected to work like a machine, it's very difficult to understand like, oh, well, we actually have processes in our state and our cities that allow us to point out the disrespect that our employers are giving us and to point out the unfairness that is happening, how our little wages that we're making are being stolen from us. So it's kind of a power. It's actually really powerful that has happened in the restaurant that I worked in. And I can tell you that happened in like three other restaurants in Los Angeles this past year where the workers organized themselves and either filed wage claims or signed petitions, wrote community letters, went to their boss and to the owners of their restaurants and were like, hey, you all owe us this much money. And the restaurant that I worked at collectively owes 13 of us almost $200,000 just being open 4 years, you know? So thank you. And that's pretty crazy, right? Like $200,000 that they stole from us in tips, wage, like working off the clock, a lot of kitchen workers. And I'm sure everybody here goes to restaurants and it's hard to believe, but these restaurants, most of them, like 90% of the restaurants that we eat at actually are stealing money from their workers in very tricky ways, ways that you don't see, you know, as a diner, as a patron. And sometimes restaurant owners are so used to that they do it without even knowing it. They just, you know, it becomes normal that your workers are going to be working off the clock after hours and closing down the restaurant or working on their breaks, clocking out and continuing to cook. It's very normal. So it's something that I think is a growing consciousness. At least in the restaurant industry, people are starting to see other people on the news, like their comrades, people that they work with in the industry, on the news, in the media, on Facebook, seeing that they're actually waging wars against their employers. Like, it's a pretty big deal, and I think it's growing right now, especially in Los Angeles, is the biggest restaurant industry in the nation, and it's also the wage theft capital. So that means that the restaurant workers in Los Angeles are experiencing wage theft on an astronomical level, and that's only what's reported. I mean, we all know that what's reported is statistics, but what really happens is a lot larger than what we see in numbers. So, where am I?
You're wonderful. That's where you are.
Thank you. Oh, you know what? I was going to talk about more about debt because just a little bit, because we think that debt just comes from, a lot of the debt that we know of comes from college loans and from big loans that we take out in mortgages and all of that. But the low-wage workers that I know, my friends and the people that I work with in the industry, everybody has crazy debt. And it's just because you can't survive off of a minimum wage, which now in Los Angeles is $9 an hour. And I was working 40 hours a week, making $10 an hour, and I don't even have kids, and I was not making it, you know? And a lot of my comrades, a lot of my coworkers, they have families, and it's fucking nuts. Oh, excuse my language. Yeah. Sorry. Oh, my goodness. All right, so, oh, gosh. Talking about policy, I'll talk about policy a little bit. I have 1 minute. In Los Angeles, we're trying to pass a wage theft ordinance because of what I've been talking about, how our wages are being taken from us every day. Even if my coworkers and I, the 13 of us, even if we win our wage claim process and our restaurant owners agree in the court of law to pay us the $200,000 or a fraction of that, only 17%. Of people who win their wage claims actually collect and see a dime of their money. And this isn't a court of law, right? This is a court order that a business has to actually pay their workers. Only 17% of people actually collect their money. So in Los Angeles, I mean, I don't even know how that works. I don't understand how businesses are not held accountable. It's just crazy to me. But we're trying to pass an ordinance which will hopefully, in policy, in theory, right, in the law, will implement a real accountability to businesses that even being guilty and found guilty in the court of law have to pay their restaurant, their workers. And that's a 4-year battle that's still climbing right now. And I hope that you all can help support us in that. Los Angeles being such a huge city of workers, of low-wage workers, it would affect all of us really, really strongly. And then connecting that to a national policy, we are also waging a war against the biggest restaurant industry company, which is Darden. They own Yard House, Olive Garden, Red Lobster. They are the worst, actually, at paying their workers, and they're the richest, right? And they control a lot of lobbyists that go to the Capitol and keep the wages low and also keep it possible for people to be taken money from. So we're also trying to build a really large battle against that company. Yeah, I think that my time is up. Thanks, guys, for listening.
Wonderful. As you can see, we've kind of come full circle, having started with the whole issue of loan sharks, basically, for the young that Barbara's telling us about, and going to a kind of wide-angle historical picture that Jack gave us of American capitalism, kind of world capitalism, going from high gap to less high to getting higher unless there's some kind of government intervention. And then we had Stephanie talking to us about various public policies that aren't helping here, but, you know, perhaps in Britain we have a better model. So what I'd like for us to do now, Dana, are you around? There's, we've got a microphone. And she's going to take it around to people who would like to comment and or ask questions. And I think it would be good if we started with some of the how did we get here type questions and moved in the end to what we can do about it. Questions. So this is Dana. Raise your hand. Here's a hand. Yeah. Okay. In the blue shirt here, in the blue shirt, Steve.
Thank you so much for this panel. In terms of how we got here. What most people don't know is in the restaurant industry, the minimum wage to this day is $2.13. The Restaurant Association got a loophole written into the law that says if you are a tipped worker, which is, best to say, mostly women, so a women's profession was legislated into law that the wage would be $2.13, and it hasn't risen one iota in 25 years. So there's California, fortunately, is one of the few states that overrode that law. And in California, okay, our waitresses are paid the minimum wage, which is $9 or $10, and so on. But most of the states, like in Arizona, it's $2.13. Wow. And I think the your organization, the Restaurant Opportunity Center, is trying to do something about this and reframing this issue as a, in a certain sense, a discrimination against women. People talk about low-wage workers or minimum-wage workers are mostly women, and people are thinking, oh, well, they're making $7 an hour. Okay, what's so bad about that? They're actually making $2.13. They have to put up with all kinds of behavior, which you have written about in your books, on the part of the customers in order to solicit or make sure that they are, you know, there used to be a song in the 60s, it's Hazel's hips that bring the tips, if you remember that. There was a story just a couple days ago in Bloomberg's Business Week about, you think that Hooters...
restaurants, it's called.
There's a new restaurant chain called Twin Peaks. Anyhow, I'm glad to see that the restaurant workers are really doing something to get that policy change, that if we're going to have a minimum wage in this country, it should apply to all workers, and there shouldn't be loopholes written in there for women.
Yeah.
And I wonder if anybody wanted to comment on that.
Is there anyone else that could speak on that issue? We're starting with policy, but that's okay. Well, this is an issue of kind of what's to be done, so it's... All right, okay. Here, let's, can you bring this over? How we got there is good, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hello, James Vann. A lot of, not much has been written about this, but the greatest transfer of wealth occurred during the Bush-Cheney, George Bush Jr. administration. The that whole fiasco of the Iraq War was manufactured to do exactly that, to take money from the wealth of the people and transfer it to a very small group of people. Under Cheney and Bush, the whole structure of the military changed. It used to be that you do KP duty when you were private or whatever. Under Cheney, soldiers didn't do any work in the Army anymore. Over 250,000 private contractors were hired by the government to do all that work, and there are still about 50,000 contractors in Iraq right now. And they were paid trillions of dollars. The money can't even be accounted for. Cheney also, they gave contracts to all their oil friends, and they got all the contracts, and Halliburton and that whole slew of people got ultra rich during that period of time. And hardly any of this is ever written about. But that was the greatest shift of financial and economic wealth in this country. And it's something that we'll probably never be able to recover from.
So what you're saying is that basically privatization has been the means, the mechanism by which the split has gotten bigger. Sorry? Yes, please, in the black. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. Hi. My name's Lana Brown, and I'd like to talk about privatization, too, because I really enjoyed Barbara Garson's comments about loans, but, of course, loans are the result of privatization. What's happened, and this is state policy, not federal primarily, is a massive shift in who's paying for higher education. Right. It is the parents of middle-class and working-class kids who are paying for it, and part of it's being paid out of loans and part's being paid directly out of their pockets. The wealthy are also paying, of course, but it's a tiny share of their income, so they haven't noticed this massive shift. But unfortunately, most middle-class and working-class people haven't noticed it either. What they've noticed are the loans, and they've noticed that tuition's gone up. And the New York Times has had a series of articles about this recently. And in my retirement, I now write comments in the New York Times under an assumed name. And I read the others. And what I find is, and this is the part that I think Stephanie Kuntz's comments are so appropriate, large amounts of hostility toward minorities and low-income people. Because no matter what the article says about what's happened, people write in and say, I had to pay for my kid, and it cost me $30,000 a year. And I see these poor kids getting Pell Grants, and I see their education being subsidized, and my kid's education, I'm having to pay it out of my pocket, and we're going into debt, and, you know, and they're not having to go into debt. Well, number one, it's not true. But the other part of it is they also don't recognize that the education that their kids are getting, that they're paying $30,000 a year for, is probably a hell of a lot better than the education that these poor kids are getting. And I mean, there's a lot of good data on this. I'm not making this up. And their kids are probably graduating. They're probably picking schools where the graduation rates are reasonable, whereas most of the poor kids are going to schools with lousy graduation rates. Right. They're ending up with all the debt and no diploma. That's even worse than diploma.
And they're for-profit schools.
But unfortunately, because there's no real national dialogue that talks about this, people end up blaming the poor and blaming minorities for an issue And it's true, they're paying out of their pockets. They're seeing that their own wealth has declined. But the focus is not where it should be. And I haven't been back to this campus in years. And I walk around and I see all these banners. We raised $3.1 billion for this and $2.5 million for that and whatever. And it's all because higher education has become privatized and is becoming increasingly segregated by income as well. And if you look at the per student costs of Berkeley versus a community college in California, you will be shocked at the differences. They make K-12, where we fought all these battles for years over equity, look like nothing. Hmm. I mean, higher ed is the place where we desperately need a redefined discussion about what's going on.
Can I interrupt?
Next speaker, yes, would you like to? Thank you very much for that excellent commentary.
Hi,
can you speak to that?
Carol Chapnick-Mukhopadhyay. I'm really glad that you brought up the points you did, because I do think it's part of how we got here, and the here is a really complex set mm-hmm. of things, of course. And a lot of them have to do with gender, which was ignored in the 60s. And the work that at least two of you have done has been wonderful in adding the gender dimension and intersecting it. And it's not just the restaurant workers, it's the domestic workers that were left out of all the labor relations laws. And one of the biggest things is also the use of family income. And Jack, you had your statistics there. And when we talk about family income, of course, they're merging the incomes of the husband and wife, or in some cases, husband and husband of the couple. And that does incredible things, including the whole tax law, whereby merging the two incomes, two worker families are paying at a much, much higher rate than a one-income family household mm-hmm. with somebody at home who we know is doing work. They're not getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. So we have this incredible subsidy through the tax law of single earner families. And we know that whole scenario, but we never talk about it. But it also affects the student loans, because what is used, again, is family income. And so we've had these policies that have been developed over the years. And of course, we know the non-working spouse was a way of subsidizing the entire capitalist system. So we got here through a lot of those things, and if we ignore the gender aspect of it, we really don't get at very, very important things. Because, again, when we talk about domestic workers, the lowest paid ones are women, and that's not by accident. And likewise, in terms of single heads of households, those are mainly women. So we can't continue ignoring gender, and again, we have to start looking at a lot of these policies, and I think one of the major ones in tax law is the subsidizing of one-earner families by all of those people who don't have that person at home doing all that unpaid labor.
Okay, do we have anyone from the panel that would like to speak to either?
I am so excited. You know, I very rarely think and get new ideas. Mm-hmm. But hearing Stephanie, hearing you, and hearing me, actually. I don't always think what I'm going to say in advance. Mm-hmm. It occurs to me how important it is to make our demands, for instance, in education. We are not going to ask for A subsidies or scholarships for four people. That's not what we need to do. We need to say education should be free.
Yes.
That is to say, the very rich who are not paying taxes are going to contribute, and so are we at lower levels, and education is a common public good.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the touchstone of all our demands, that We're going to make same thing in medicine, same thing in all these things. Not you get it, you get on Medicaid and blah, blah, blah. It would be like, for instance, in Sweden, welfare doesn't mean giving to a poor person. It means just the general goods. Even lunches, free lunches in Sweden are part of the welfare for working people. So I'm not going to go any longer, but it all comes together that way. And we've reached a point where it's not going to be special pleading for, it's where I began, it's not going to be special pleading for one group or another because we are all in the 99%. Yeah. Actually, 99.9. It's only, yeah. It should not, we're not, we should not be considering wages, we're considering an income. We should be considering wealth. We have to tax that wealth that's been hiding and use it to provide a comfortable country for everyone, not... Right. Not just poor or, I mean, you know what I mean. Great. Great. And everybody here has come up with it. I'm so excited.
Thank you, Barbara. And now, Jack.
Yeah. Yes, we're sitting here in a university setting, and it's appropriate for us to be focusing in on education. And education is certainly a big part of the issue, but it's also minimum wage.
Yeah.
It's also tax rates. It's also taxes on wealth and on inheritance. It's also the issue of the political power of the wealthy and the whole Citizens United. There's a whole agenda of repairing the whole trend toward economic inequality. And I urge everybody not to think of this in terms of what you can pass in Congress today or what the public is ready to hear today. When the civil rights movement kicked off in the 1960s with the sit-down in North Carolina and Greensboro, they weren't saying, what kind of civil rights law can we get passed? They said, this is right, and we're going to do the thing that's right. And social movements are what's needed to change the political situation in the country to make all of these things right. And one, no, I lost it. Okay.
Can I add one thing?
Yes. Maybe.
I hate to be the, I hate to sound like a killjoy here, but I spend a lot of my time on radio shows talking to people about family issues. And listening to the kinds of prejudices that working people like us, working people like my father, still have. You can't just say to them, we're going to tax wealth. You've got to prove that it's unearned wealth.
Yes, it's unearned.
Well, I'm just saying that we have to be very careful how we do these things. People believe that you should. I mean, like the right wing knows how to do this. They talk about the death tax, you know, instead of the Paris Hilton tax. So we really need to think through how we talk about this. And a lot of our 60s rhetoric is not appropriate for dealing with the particular ideological challenges that we have.
Okay, one more, Jack, and then we'll move on.
This is what I forgot to say. When my mind went blank, and that is, you know, we went through the Occupy movement that in some way raised the level of awareness of this. But if you're a movement that's saying we are the 99%, then that movement has to find messages and images that the 99% are saying those people are speaking for me. And I think that our movements have been too much involved in self-expression and too much involved in our acting out who we are and acting out our sense of ourselves, and have been very unprofessional in identifying who are the people that we're trying to identify with. Who do we want our message to resonate with? What kind of images, what kind of language are we going to use? We always talk to each other. We always talk to other wealthy or educated people. You know, it's really, and I agree with Stephanie, not that we shouldn't take a very ambitious agenda, but I do think that our movement that we created has had a very self-indulgent side to it in speaking to itself and expressing itself and not trying to identify who are the people who have to identify with us and how do we resonate with them.
Who can speak to that issue? Over here? Yes.
I can speak to that issue as a young black man. So, I want to say Ted Vincent is my grandfather. I don't know if many people know his book, his books.
Yes.
And Toni Vincent is my grandmother. And I spent the last 2 years living on a 10-acre reserve that Tony set up for our family to investigate off-the-grid lifestyles and alternative lifestyles and spiritual growth. And I want to say that I don't want to go into too many details, obviously, because we don't have time for all that. But in my personal life experience, as a, you know, Ted never earned any money. He spent all his time writing books. And Toni was always doing whatever she does. She's a very private and secretive person. Even to this day, even as her landlord and manager, she keeps a lot of information away from me. But money is private. And we all have to respect our relationship to money. And we all have a relationship with the bank, if you have a bank account, which I'm almost assuredly all of you do. That private relationship is not public information, and it cannot be legislated. With some caveats. The bank is managed by the government. The FDIC, the insurance companies, those are all managed by the government. And there's a very religious and moral issue with your relationship with the bank. And it is what is destroying your grandchildren. It is destroying their lifestyles, maybe starving them, it may be killing them, whether they are born or unborn. And that issue is reflected in the religious concept of usury sin. It is an issue that the Catholic Church used for hundreds of years to murder Jews. I'm a black Jew, so I know the history. You know, my alternate name, because of the Jewish side of my family, rejected the Theodore Vincent side of the family, is David Caro Green. And Caro is the writer of the Jewish customs, of Jewish law. And in Jewish law, this sin is actually discussed a lot. And at that point in history, Jews were being murdered for usury sin. This is in the 1600s when those laws were written. The purpose of my statement is this, is that you need to reflect, because there's no politician who's willing to confront the bank. If you people here cannot confront the interest rate issue, usury sin, defined by old, ancient Orthodox law, that's Muslim law, Catholic law, Jewish law, is 4%. How many of you are paying more than 4% on your residential properties, on your business ownership, and on your student loans? These are large figures. That 4% figure, it could be worth a life in the past. And in some more serious Orthodox countries, you can still be murdered by your government or punished to death for restricting a person's ability to grow in their life. Because the finance limits your life. It limits how much food you can eat, how much real estate you can manage, how your voice is heard. So that's the point that I want to reflect on, is that, and then this is, you know, I graduated from Berkeley in 2002. I was a Wells Fargo banker. I instantiated loans for Wells Fargo, and I quit when the man told me that I could not progress as the highest performing banker in Marin County because I need to sit in my seat for 3 years like he did.
Okay.
So I want you to reflect on that.
Okay. So that's a policy issue that goes very much to the people. Dana, how about this this man in the plaid shirt? Yeah.
Yeah, hi. I'm Lawrence Scheckman. I was Michael in the 60s. And I think I still hold the world's record for the longest time to get a master's degree in sociology. I'm glad we have gotten to what is to be done, which I take to mean what kind of social movement do we need. And I conclude from the fast food workers and from the Walmart workers that we need an entirely new labor movement and community movement. And the reason is this. Nowadays, 80% of the American labor force is in so-called service industries. In the 30s, we had the Congress of Industrial Organizations. Now we have service workers, and the labor movement hasn't caught up to that. What that means, what particularly determines a service worker, is that you are in intimate contact pretty much every day with the community around you, unlike industrial or miners. This means that you can only win a strike with the support of the community, with the support of your customers. Now, I understand that the fast food workers are doing that. They're going around and saying, well, come, you know, the community organizations, the churches, help us out. That's great, but it's not enough. The reason that it's not enough is because the present day unions will not allow neighbors not just to boycott or to join the picket line, but they will not allow neighbors to organize new workers. This means that we have to have pretty much one organization or two, perhaps, that are very closely aligned, where neighbors are being organized into co-ops and into mutual aid. That's what I do. And at the same time, the neighbors have committed, or at least a committee of the neighbors, that they will go and organize all of the workers in their neighborhoods. And that the workers that are being organized will be organized not just for unions and higher wages and better working conditions, but to the full extent possible, make those workplaces into co-ops, into workers' co-ops. So this way we will have one movement which encompasses co-ops and mutual aid in the neighborhoods, and the same organization will be building mutual aid and co-ops among the workplaces.
Okay.
I know that that's not happening now, because when down in Occupy Oakland, when we marched on the waterfront with the ILWU, the ILWU held meetings with the Occupy people under the condition that no decisions be made at those joint meetings, and that the neighborhood people and the movement people had no role in deciding anything.
Okay.
And no role in organizing.
All right.
I conclude we need
Thank you.
Entirely new movement that's going to unite those two, and the precedent for it is the Knights of Labor in the 1880s.
Good. Okay, thank you very much. We're going to take a few more comments, and then I'm going to ask the panel each for their final kind of nugget summaries on this. Yes, in the back, in the blue sweater. Dana? Yeah. That's you.
Where
yeah.
Do we go?
Yeah, right there.
Okay, my name is Diana Scott, and I just want to call attention to something I saw last night accidentally on TV on the Tavis Smiley Show. A professor at UCLA, I believe her name is Hannah Appel, and I don't remember whether she's anthropology or something else, is working to organize students with debt so that they can somehow pool debt and leverage renegotiating rates the way mega companies are able to do. And this was really astounding, and I have to explore it further, and I encourage you to.
Fantastic idea. Okay.
Hannah Appel, A-P-P-E-L.
Okay. Dana, we have a speaker, a commentator way over here. Going to get your exercise. Yeah. Just a minute. She's going to bring you your...
Am I supposed to be speaking?
You are, but with a microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sir, what is the gentleman in the green shirt?
Jack.
Yeah, Brother Jack said, look, let's wrap our heads around this problem. He called it self-indulgence. But you see, it is a political disease that stops us from even getting to first base. I call it narcissism. Doesn't matter. It started, and I tell you, I was raised by people... that lived through the 30s. So that's the way my mind works today. That's the way I was raised. But I noticed in the 70s, that's when they started that bullshit about that nonsense about the personal is political. And what you started to see was a real fracturing of the social movements. So black people started talking, not just that we want our rights as citizens, but started to develop these crackpot nationalist theories about black people are a separate nation and Negro land and we want two states and blah, blah, blah. No, listen, it's not funny, because, you know, they talk about computers, garbage in, garbage out. If you start off from a poison well, you can't get to freedom from a poison well. A false theory like that only engenders an unhealthy movement that is incapable. in reaching these reactionary utopian goals. There is no black nation. Black people are Americans,
yes,
whether we like it or not. But, I mean, that's yeah, what we are. Yeah. No, but wait, but see, but what happens if you think this false theory is your salvation? You wind up walking off the cliff with the blindfolds. Mm-hmm. Off with the blindfolds.
Right.
This self-indulgent stuff is poison. Mm. It is poison. It is not a minor point. You need to talk to your grandchildren about this, because this stuff came up. I was very active in Occupy Oakland. So you see it all the time amongst the young people, what they think is important. And it's that me, I'm a one-legged, cripple, blind, so-and-so from Bangladesh. Or so. Come on! Come on, let's get free here. We got serious problems. So, I mean, I think that that is not a minor issue about how people, we have been taken off the rails because of a false philosophical approach that leads us to not go in the direction
to
of
be
human
divided.
Liberation. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take too much time.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. What you're saying is we get all divided up. Okay, you know what? We're going to have to stop at this. I'm now going to turn to our panelists in the same order in which they began. Your final wisdom, each one of you.
In
30
seconds?
Yep.
In 30 seconds.
Yeah.
There you go. You want to start.
My wisdom came right out of the discussion here. We're not asking for special grants for special people. We're asking for the general population to be a tax on wealth, or to be a normal tax by which we do things collectively. I use the schools as an example. We want schools. That's good for everybody. We want health care. That's good for everybody. It may even extend to healthy foods. I don't know. It's kind of creeping socialism. It's true. But so I'm really, we're not going to be asking, we're not going to, I would like not to be putting in demands for specific underprivileged people, but to recognize that as wealth accumulates in fewer and fewer hands, we have to take it back for all of us underprivileged people.
Very good. Thank you, Jack.
There was an article in the press this week about a Harvard Business School study asking people in the country what they thought the difference pay between a CEO and the average worker. And people guess about 30 times, and the actual number is 300 times. Nobody got it right. And that's double any other country, and many times more than that. I think there is a lot of lack of information out there about how far inequality has gone. I think there's a lot of messages we can get out. In the fast food business, the differential between CEOs and the average worker is 1,200 times. So these are simple facts that we can get out. I think we have to develop a whole series of messages. We're not jealous of these people. We don't hate them as individuals, we don't crave their wealth. But there's been a redistribution of wealth and therefore a redistribution of power, and now the vast majority of Americans are suffering. They're partly suffering because they've been tricked into all of this resentment against all the various progress that's been made on social issues, and it's our job now to turn that around.
Wonderful. Yes, great. Stephanie.
Well, I certainly agree with all of those things, the need for universalistic policies. I think of race, gender, and class sort of like the strands of a rope. They're all tied together. And sometimes one will come to the fore, and we have to organize on that when you see something like the racism at Ferguson or the gender issues that we see in sexual assaults. But I think that we did give too much to identity politics for a while and not deal with the class issues. So I'm glad to see people really thinking that through. But I have to say again, I always like to kind of be, I guess, the naysayer or whatever group I'm in. So since I'm in with a group of like thinkers, I just have to challenge you that there are words we use that most American people are potential allies will not accept. Collectivity is one. Say social program on a radio show, and they hear program. You know, use welfare. Even if you're using it in the way it should be, which is well-being, we have to be able to take back the vocabulary that the right wing has spent 20 years building up so that they get these sort of conditioned Pavlovian responses even in people who should be on our side, and we have to learn to talk to them better.
Great, great. Sumi.
I don't know, maybe some of you all will hate me after this, but I actually think that personal is very political. And where I come from in Los Angeles, the people that I'm making community with, a lot of transgender people, a lot of queer people, a lot of working class people, and mostly people of color, which, by the way, we're kind of the majority by now, I think. I don't think we're minorities anymore. I have to say that personal is very political, and the leaders that I know that are leading pretty radical movements down in Los Angeles and across the nation are people that are very interested in understanding where they're coming from, where their history is, very interested in where spirituality lives within them, very interested in talking about the traumas that we go through from day one that we're living on this earth and how that informs our politics, how that informs how we walk in life, and also how that dictates how we connect to each other. So I think that all of that is really important, and to not pay attention to that and to not honor that is kind of moving closer to being a machine, in my opinion. And I know that we're talking about identity politics becoming very overwhelmingly influencing to our movements, but I do think that personal identity is extremely important in, first of all, being a self-determined individual and being able to see each other and connecting our struggles and our strengths. So.
Okay, and
very unusual.
Okay, one more comment from Barbara.
Something unusual for me. I want to recommend someone else's book. I think that Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, gives us one way to approach the inequality problem too, which is to say, it's a little difficult to read also, but it suggests to the climate movement what we can suggest also. Even though we're up against something very big and that fighting it could be very, very dismal, we're talking about heat and cold, and, you know, but it is an opportunity if we, and I will think of the word, Stephanie, to say it better, if we regulate unregulated capitalism, it is actually an opportunity to build a more fun world, maybe not a more... And fighting climate change may lead us in that direction because we can't let unregulated capitalism regulate themselves. And fighting inequality can lead us into a direction of a simply more enjoyable world.
Okay.
And I do recommend everything. This changes everything.
Well, I think, you know, we all do have personal identities, but that's the whole point of it. We all have them, and we need to show what we share. So I want to thank our panel and very much. And thank you very much.